At this hour, fires are still burning on the south side of Minneapolis after protesters took to the streets to demand justice for George Floyd.
Simmering outrage boiled over this week in cities all over the country. From WNYC in New York, this is On the Media. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield. An incident in Central Park prompts examination of the Becky, the Patty, and especially the Karen memes, signifying white women who feel entitled to call the cops on people guilty of living while black.
We are still grappling with the same racism that we were dealing with under Jim Crow era segregation. And that's central to these memes.
And has the president's best buddy turned Fremeny?
Twitter fact-checked President Trump today for the first time. It's all over a tweet he sent about California's mail-in ballots.
It's all coming up after this.
This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. What if comparing car insurance rates was as easy as putting on your favorite podcast? With Progressive, it is. Just visit the Progressive website to quote with all the coverages you want. You'll see Progressive's direct rate. Then their tool will provide options from other companies so you can compare. All you need to do is choose the rate and coverage you like. Quote today at Progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Comparison rates not available in all states or situations. Prices vary based on how you buy.
Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
From WNYC in New York, this is On the Media. I'm Bob Garfield.
This week, another name was added to the toll of black men and women killed by the police.
The victim's been named as George Floyd.
He was 46 years old, grew up in Houston, but moved to Minnesota in search of a better life. He worked security at a restaurant till coronavirus shut it down. On Monday, he was accused of using a counterfeit 20 in a grocery store.
Videos emerged showing a police officer kneeling on his neck in the street for some considerable time.
Nearly 8 minutes.
My stomach hurts. My neck hurts. Everything hurts.
On Tuesday, the protests started.
At this hour, fires are still burning on the south side of Minneapolis after protesters took to the streets.
On Wednesday, riots.
Overnight, Minneapolis on fire. Protesters leaving an auto parts store in flames. Others seen looting a local Target.
And Thursday,
chaotic protests continuing throughout the night. This is video of a Minneapolis police station that was set on fire a few hours ago.
The president tweeted just a short time ago, and I want to read the whole thing. He says, "I can't stand back and watch this happen to a great American city, Minneapolis. A total lack of leadership. Either the very weak radical left mayor, Jacob Frey, gets together and brings the city under control, or I will send in the National Guard and get the job done right. These thugs are dishonoring the memory of George Floyd, and I won't let that happen. Any difficulty, we will assume control." And then again, an extraordinary line, "When the looting starts, the shooting starts."
Thursday night also saw protests in Phoenix, Denver, Memphis, Columbus, New York City, and in Louisville. Peaceful protests demanding justice for the shooting death of Breonna Taylor during a police raid in March turned violent.
I think America must see that riots do not develop out of thin air.
Martin Luther King in April 1967, a year before his assassination.
Certain conditions continue to exist in our society, which must be condemned as vigorously as we condemn riots. But in the final analysis, a riot is the language of the unheard. What is it that America has failed to hear? It has failed to hear that large segments of white society are more concerned about tranquility and the status quo than about justice, equality, and humanity. And so in a real sense, our nation's summers of riots are caused by our nation's winters of delay.
6 summers ago, months of unrest followed the police shooting of Michael Brown, launching the Black Lives Matter movement. Now, as video evidence of abuse of power piles up amid a pandemic that has killed black people at a strikingly disproportionate rate, the sense that black lives still don't matter is hard to shake. Take the murder in February of another black man also caught on video.
Ahmaud Arbery, a young black man who in February, almost to the day it happened to Trayvon Martin 8 years ago, was chased down by white men in pickup trucks and shot and killed on a residential street in Georgia.
A reminder of why incidents like this other one on Monday in New York City's Central Park are so harrowing. A white woman named Amy Cooper had her dog off leash in a part of the park where leashes are required. A black man, Christian Cooper, an ardent birdwatcher, asked her to leash said dog. From there, things escalated.
Please don't come close to me.
Sir, I'm asking you to stop recording me.
Please don't come close to me.
Please take your phone off.
Please don't come close to me.
I'm taking pictures and calling the cops.
Please call the cops. Please call the cops.
I'm going to tell them there's an African-American man threatening my life.
Please tell them whatever you like.
There is an African-American man. I am in Central Park. He is recording me and threatening myself and my dog. I'm sorry, I can't hear you either. I'm being threatened by a man in the Ramble. Please send the cops immediately.
Cooper lost her job, lost her dog, and was dubbed a Karen. We turn to a 2018 Saturday Night Live for guidance.
Let's go to white people for $400.
Your friend Karen brings her potato salad to your cookout. Uh-oh, T'Challa.
This woman, Karen, she is Caucasian, eh?
Yes.
And she has her own recipe for potato salad, eh?
Yeah, yeah.
And although I have never had potato salad.
Of course.
I sense that this white woman does not season her food.
That's right.
And if she does, it is only with a tiny bit of salt.
That's exactly right. Yeah.
And no paprika.
No paprika, no.
And she will probably add something unnecessary like raisins.
I know, right?
So, something tells me that I should say...
Say it!
Oh, hell nah, Karen. Keep your brand-ass potato salad to yourself.
In recent years, Karen has transformed, no longer just an entitled white lady, but one who wants to speak to your manager. Another SNL instructional.
While working at his lab located above a Tory Burch, Dr. Bruce Banner was hit with gamma radiation in a failed experiment, causing him to transform into an emboldened white lady whenever he is provoked. He is the Impossible Hulk.
Sir, the store policy is...
No, you're being aggressive. I'm calling the police.
For what?
911, what's your emergency?
Yes, hello, yes. I'd like to report an act of aggression.
We are literally just standing.
No, they're crowding me. I cannot breathe.
Sir, just take your money back. It's fine.
No, do not rush me. Do not try to silence me.
This dude is impossible.
April Williams is a professor of communications and media at the University of Michigan, and she says the Karen meme resurged with a vengeance last month.
A woman named Karen was denying that COVID-19 was real, became ill, and unfortunately she passed away. And one of the things that I'm seeing is people saying, look, this is peak Karen behavior. The whole reason why this person had posted originally and was protesting was because she believed that states should reopen, the economy is failing, and she wanted to be able to go to the store and get her nails done and all those types of things. I think this resurgence in conversations about what a Karen is because of the conversations on COVID-19. But I do want to actually go back and talk about the origins of Karens and Beckys and how those all fit together. I would say in the Black community, a Becky or a Karen or a Susan or a Patty even is a cultural signifier. And a signifier is really just when a community or a sub-community is using particular patterns of language coded so that members of that community can quickly pick up on this referential piece, right?
Is there a difference between a Karen and a Susan?
There is, but Karen, Becky, Susan are all the same type at different ages and also different economic and social classes.
Could you decode a little bit? What's the difference between a Karen and a Kylie? Say?
Yeah, so Kylie is typically for folks who are younger, 15 to 20 year old. Kylie, for whatever reason, is just the name that we've settled on. Becky is anywhere from 20 years old to mid 30s range. People probably say that this kind of person is quote unquote basic, meaning peak whiteness, right? Things like pumpkin spice lattes, we would associate with a Becky. Once you've reached the Becky stage, now you're a Karen, mid-30s to mid-40s. You're used to having the entitlement now, and you're comfortable enough to say, you know what, I want to talk to your manager. Karen is classically associated with this idea of calling the manager. So this Karen, the manager that she's calling is the police, but it can be any situation in which a white woman is not satisfied and is now going to call the manager.
So this Karen, Amy Cooper, experienced some real fallout, a lost job, a lost dog, public shaming. Do these memes seek a consequence, or are they simply a form of expression?
The memes themselves are a form of expression. I also frame them as an act of resistance against this casual white supremacy, because ultimately, when they call the police on Black people, that's what they're doing. They're upholding a white supremacist system. When these memes circulate, they're calling attention to the fact that this white supremacy is the norm, right? The memes themselves don't necessarily say, like, oh, we should fire this person. But the text that accompanies the meme, they'll often say, this person deserves to be fired.
Now, Karen is one in a long line of sobriquet, shall we say, given to white women across the decades. And you've been doing deep research into the BBQ Becky phenomenon, which started with a woman named Jennifer Schulte.
Yes, that's right. This occurred on April 28th, 2018. I've been following and collecting data about tweets related to Jennifer Schulte since then, and also another white woman, Allison Edel. On June 23rd, 2018, Allison Edel, who was dubbed Permit Patty, called the police on an 8-year-old girl who was selling bottled water outside of her apartment building.
She called the police on an 8-year-old little girl. You can hide all you want. The whole world gonna see you, boo.
Yeah, and illegally selling water without a permit? Yeah.
On my property.
It's not your property.
Yeah, so these are the two cases that really sort of sparked this Living While Black moment. And as these two cases were occurring pretty closely together, people are starting to recognize a pattern, and they're even starting to use the same kinds of framing when they're creating the memes. We had Barbecue Becky, and then we had Permit Patty, and now we have Central Park Karen.
You've described something else these incidents have in common, which is these women are frequently likely to underplay the role of race in their actions. You refer to something called the epistemology of ignorance.
Yes, that's right. So the whole entire apparatus of whiteness is dedicated to maintaining this myth that racism doesn't exist, that we're all equal, and life is much better when people don't talk about race, right? And so these white women perform this ignorance about race when they make these calls into the police. And it's really interesting because actually Central Park Karen explicitly says, you're an African-American and I'm going to call the police and tell them that, right? It's a little bit different because in previous cases, we saw people were wanting to shy away from the fact that they were engaging in a racially charged incident. Whereas this Karen is relying on this heated racialized narrative to cause panic in this man.
So give me a sense of how this epistemology of ignorance plays out, though.
So Barbecue Becky called 911 several times over the course of 2 hours about this family who was grilling with charcoal grills. And apparently charcoal grilling wasn't allowed in that part of the park. Allegedly. No one's really sure. I still have not gained clarity because you are allowed to grill there. The question is just whether or not you're allowed to use charcoal. So she's calling and she's saying, I don't want our children to be burned by hot coals and to waste taxpayer money. I'm not making that up.
I'd like it dealt with immediately so that Kohl's don't bring more children and our city has to pay more taxes.
I need a description of them. What race are they?
African American.
And how old approximately?
I'd say about 40.
Okay.
Or late 30s.
What color clothing is he wearing?
He is wearing dark black pants that are ripped and a black sweatshirt.
But when the 911 responder is asking her about her race, the 911 prompter actually says the police won't be able to find you and help you if they don't know who they're looking for.
What race are you and how old are you?
My race doesn't matter.
How are they going to find you? They're looking for you right now. You won't even tell me.
Where are they? I am at Cleveland, okay? I am a white person.
Performing this ethos of race not mattering, she's white, and as a white woman, she should not have to explain. And also, I think maybe she doesn't want to be identified as a white woman. They're recording me, right? So she's sort of pulling away from wanting to tell them that she's a white woman herself.
At this point, you've compiled about 56,000 tweets about 15 cases of mostly white women calling the police on black people for what you call living while black.
So I've actually collected 89,000 tweets in total.
Wow.
Yeah, about all these incidences. And I'm going to just list them for you. And listeners are free to go and check them out on Twitter. So in addition to Barbecue Becky and Permit Patty, I've also collected data on Bus Barada Brenda, Lawnmower Lucy, Pool Patrol Paula, Racist Roslyn, Burrito.
That was pretty explicit.
Burrito Bill, Jogger Joe, Walmart Mary, Airline Amy, Road Raging Randy, Loud Music Maggie, and Candy Bar Cora.
So there were three guys in there. Assuming the Road Rage Randy was a guy, but
yes,
maybe not.
Yeah, Road Raging Randy is a guy.
Which one drove you the most crazy?
The one that I love to hate the most is Barbecue Becky. just because the fact that she called into 911 multiple times and stuck around for 2 hours harassing these people. When a white woman in the past made an accusation about a black man, it resulted in his death. Here, maybe it's a little bit harder for people of white backgrounds to see, but for the black community, we can see those dots connected very easily in the way that if this black man who was birdwatching in Central Park, if the police had come out because of Central Park Karen, there may have been an altercation. Who knows? This black man could very well have ended up dead. And that's the scary part. That's how we see this framing. We see this racism continuing from our ideas of white women have historically had the power to say to black men in particular, you are doing something that threatens me, even if that thing that's threatening is just existing in a black body, just walking down the street, just bird watching. But because these white people feel that these black individuals have stepped out of a particular social order or have inconvenienced them in some way, they feel that they have the authority to regulate how black bodies act and are treated in public society in the U.S.
You've said that these memes flip the discourse.
Yeah. The memes serve as a stand-in for traditional black news reporting outlets that we had in the past, but we've now sort of lost. And they also serve to call attention to the broader popular culture community and the broader news media, right? If people weren't making memes about these types of events and these incidences, then I'm not sure that they would have the same level of notoriety or the same level of popularity and press as they do right now.
Right. In some states, they're passing living while black laws. That's a phrase that doesn't emerge from a congressional committee. It comes from somewhere else. And you've got Representative Bynum in Oregon. She said that memes spurred her desire to write legislation like that.
Yeah, someone called the police on her while she was out campaigning. And so her own personal experience, also coupled with the abundance of memes, spurred her on to write legislation that would make it illegal to call the police on Black people for doing things that are not illegal. And so we're seeing that in Oregon, in Grand Rapids, Michigan, they are working on similar legislation that would make it illegal to call the police on people for living while Black. And I do believe the memes play a part of a greater social movement. As they're situated on Twitter within the larger discourse, talking about what it means to live while Black, talking about what it means to be policed for doing everyday activities. One of the cool things about the memes is that they help white people to laugh at themselves, and they also help them to understand that what's happening in the meme is wrong, right? And so I don't want to be the next barbecue Becky. And so the meme sort of helped to have those cultural conversations that are difficult to have.
How does this turn towards looking at the racist actions of certain white women relate to this whole issue of white fragility, this notion that if you put me on the spot or suggest that I'm racist, I might cry?
That's a great question. I think it's really interesting that in most of these situations, the white women who are calling the police are comfortable before they realize they're being recorded. Once they sort of recognize that they're being recorded, and according to Robin DiAngelo, who we attribute that idea of white fragility to, when there's a calling of account of that racism, tears are often used to draw attention away from the harm that they're causing and turn the attention back on them as the innocent.
About these memes, is the point here that they're forcing people to recognize that race is at the heart of each of these incidents, not a marginal issue. It is the only real issue.
It is the primary motivating factor for placing that call to the police. I'm not sure that if these incidences were happening to white people, that they would feel the need to call the police at all. If they were, we would hear about it, as we have recently with COVID, where white people are being kicked out of stores because they refuse to wear a mask. So if it were the case that white people were calling the police randomly on other white people, I think we would hear about it. The fact that these incidences keep happening to Black people, Black men in particular, says that we are still grappling with the same type of racism that we were dealing with under Jim Crow era segregation. And that's central to these memes.
April, thank you so much.
You're welcome. Thank you so much.
April Williams is a professor of communications and media at the University of Michigan and a research fellow at the Berkman Klein Center for Internet and Society at Harvard University.
Coming up, how to reckon with white power of the double X variety.
This is On the Media.
This is On the Media. I'm Bob Garfield.
And I'm Brooke Gladstone. April Williams described the memes that have emerged from encounters between some white women and men, quote, living while Black. So how do we get to a better place? Jesse Daniels is a sociology professor at Hunter College in the CUNY Graduate Center and author of the upcoming book, Undoing White Womanhood.
There's real deadly power in a white woman calling 911 or pointing her finger at a person of color saying he's the one that did it. And that really connects to a much longer history in the United States. I mean, we could go all the way back to slavery, but I think most people have a more recent memory of someone like Carolyn Bryant, who pointed a finger at Emmett Till and got him quite literally killed, brutally so, and then many decades later recanted, said it didn't happen. And that specific kind of power, I think, really hasn't been examined thoroughly.
So let's talk about the long-term impact of that power. You noted that the 911 emergency call system we have is in many ways an outgrowth of the iconic murder of a woman, Kitty Genovese, in Queens, New York.
Yeah, this is an interesting and terrible story. Kitty Genovese, as many people know, was raped and murdered trying to get home from her job tending bar one night and was attacked just outside of her apartment. The reporting at the time was that dozens of people heard her cries for help and didn't call anyone. We know later that that's not actually what happened, but that story kind of lived on about her murder. And what many people began to clamor for after that was an easy way to call the police. Her surviving brother, in a documentary just a couple of years ago, said that he and the family look on the 911 system as one of the silver linings of her brutal murder. But what's interesting to me is that it really connects to this history of white women and this mythology of the brutal black man. That is a kind of central story in the American cultural landscape. I mean, Ida B. Wells Burnett wrote in The Red Record, 1895, that the big lie of lynching was that white women were being attacked by black men. And that story is deeply encoded in the American culture.
How in our daily lives can we disrupt this idea?
That's a great question. I think, you know, one of the ways that we can disrupt this in our daily lives is by treating other people with respect and following the rules that everybody else has to follow. There was another meme that appeared on the internet recently. It's a woman who's, I don't know, in her 50s or 60s. She's driving a pickup truck and a police officer stops her to give her a ticket. It's like an $80 ticket. And she keeps arguing with him that she doesn't deserve it and he doesn't understand that she doesn't deserve it. She rolls up her window and drives away.
The Oklahoma woman who was resisting arrest after she was pulled over for a broken taillight and refused the ticket and yelled at the officer was Deborah Hamill, 65 years old. "Yeah, I tried to kick you because I'm a country girl," she told the officer. "I don't like being thrown on the floor."
"You don't want to sign it?"
"No, because I don't think that I deserve to pay $80 for something that is fixable and I can fix it,
right,
if that's all you want
to
do."
"Go ahead, step out of the car."
"Why?"
"Because you're under arrest. Step out. Step out of the vehicle."
"No, I'm not."
"Step out."
It ends up with her on the ground, out of her truck, under arrest. There's something about that that so embodies this meme of white women who don't think that the rules apply to them. So, I mean, I think one of the ways that we can disrupt the specialness that's been attached to white womanhood in our daily lives is to recognize that we're not that special, that we have to follow the rules like everybody else. Amusing as that video is to watch, if you flip the script and you imagine her as a black woman or as a Latinx woman, and certainly if she were a black man, you know, they might have ended up dead at the end of that encounter. And that's not funny at all. And that's part of why this is so serious to me.
You have a book coming out soon called Undoing White Womanhood. What were you driven to examine in that book?
Well, I've really been thinking about this for decades now. Most of my research has been on white supremacists, white nationalists, that sort of thing. And when I was spending a lot of time at Stormfront, for example, so white supremacist portal, for a long time, it was the largest one, the only one online. And, you know, the Southern Poverty Law Center's linked at least 100 murders from people who had some association to Stormfront. It's a vile place on the internet. And a place that I wandered into on that portal was a whole discussion board called the Ladies Only Forum. And it was populated by white women. And they were talking about equal pay for equal work. Abortion rights, you know, how silly and foolish the men in their lives are. It sounded so ordinary and so feminist. And that really threw me. I mean, I was like, what's going on here? And part of what I concluded is that feminism, if it doesn't have a central understanding of race and racism, is completely compatible with white supremacy.
What do you want readers to take away from your book?
Well, what I really want readers to understand is that we white women have a specific cultural history in this country, and we have a real responsibility to not do more harm as white women, not to continue to do harm. We've got to do better.
Thank you so much.
It was great talking to you.
Jesse Daniels is a faculty associate at the Harvard Berkman Klein Center and a sociology professor at Hunter College and the CUNY Graduate Center.
Coming up, the president's newest nemesis is also his best friend, Twitter.
This is On the Media. This is On the Media. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield. When the looting starts, tweeted the President of the United States Friday morning, the shooting starts. There's no need to unpack all of the animus behind his threat to bring the hammer down in the Twin Cities. The violent couplet speaks for itself. But the tweet was posted in a new reality. About 3 hours later, the Twitter comms account retweeted Trump's tweet with this note. We have placed a public interest notice on this tweet from @RealDonaldTrump.
Twitter flagged that, as you said, as a violation of its rules about glorifying violence. That means users can't see that shooting line unless they specifically click on it.
This was the culmination of a tumultuous week when the man who puts the bully in bully pulpit was finally, if incrementally, chastened by the very platform on which he most relies.
The president had claimed that postal ballots would lead to voter fraud in this year's election.
Well, Twitter fact-checked President Trump today for the first time.
With a link to CNN and Washington Post fact-checkers who debunked the president's claim as false.
He claims the company is stifling his free speech. He says he will, quote, not allow it to happen.
Twitter has never held Donald Trump to the same standards of truth and civility it demands of ordinary users. Till now, it reacted not at all to his ad hominem attacks, accusations of treason, incitements to violence, even his recently resurrected charge that former congressman and current TV nemesis NBC host Joe Scarborough was implicated in a 2001 murder.
A woman who worked for Joe Scarborough, not directly, she worked in a field office, had a heart arrhythmia. She fell and hit her head and died.
New York Times contributor Kara Swisher wrote about the bizarre melodrama unfolding before our eyes.
Since then, there's been a really weird conspiracy theory around her death and that she was involved with then-Congressman Scarborough and that he killed her. He was hundreds of miles away at the time. The whole thing has been disproven so many times, but it's still endured.
For the widower of Laurie Clazoutis, it has been a nightmare upon a nightmare. Timothy Clazoutis has begged Twitter to delete Trump's tweets, and Joe Scarborough has begged Trump to cease and desist the grotesque behavior. Trump, for his part, claims that Twitter deleting tweets or otherwise intervening would violate his First Amendment right to free speech. Would you please explain why that misunderstands the Constitution?
It's not what it says. The First Amendment says that Congress shall make no law abridging freedom of speech. And it does not say that Twitter can make no law. It does not say Facebook can make no law. He's characterizing them as public squares, which they are not, even if they seem like it. And he's saying that he can say anything he wants on them because of that. And it's just not true. They've just allowed him to do so. And that's very different from having the right to do so.
Certainly, Twitter users who are not U.S. presidents must follow the rules. Here are a couple of users complaining on YouTube about having their accounts suspended.
Basically, my Twitter was banned because I responded saying the N-word with the A. I didn't know you can get banned for that.
I got suspended for saying, please start using the right your or I'm going to kill you. And I'm guessing they suspended me for the kill you part, as if I'm going to kill someone over grammar. That's insane.
In fact, for more than 4 years, Twitter has elected to give Trump and other world leaders unfettered access to their followers on the grounds of newsworthiness, the same justifications invoked by mainstream media for disseminating and amplifying every Trump paroxysm of id since the 2016 campaign. At Twitter's annual shareholder meeting on Wednesday, interim CEO Jack Dorsey found himself with both a languishing stock price and investors agitating about the impunity afforded Trump. Dorsey responded with his usual vagueness about cleansing bad information with good information.
First and foremost, I believe that the truth always emerges. The truth always comes out.
I asked Kara Swisher if that's just wishful thinking. When the liars and propagandists have 80 million followers, that does give untruth an edge, does it not?
It certainly does. The problem is you can't check everything because there's going to be lies all over the place, right? Because these are platforms designed for lying, 100%. They're designed for a lot of things, but liars do well on these platforms. And so you're not going to be able to police everything, but so you have to make examples of people. And when it's so egregious and actually has a potential to suppress voting or to cause health damage, it's your duty as a company to point it out.
Yet by that moment, Twitter's platitudes had already transformed into some degree of action. Modest, but as it turns out, momentous. On Tuesday, Twitter had appended a caution flag to two Trump tweets alleging widespread fraud in mail-in voting. The allegation, a frequent Trump refrain, wasn't true. So, Twitter added a fact-check link.
Yeah, it's the most minor thing you can do. They inform you that this tweet was potentially misleading. And then they link to stories which, in this case, debunked everything Trump was saying.
Minor? Not to Trump and his allies, who immediately started retaliating. This was presidential counselor Kellyanne Conway on Fox, sicking the president's followers on a Twitter employee who had years ago used the platform to ridicule the president.
The name of somebody at Twitter, he's the head of integrity, and his name is somebody in San Francisco will wake him up and tell him he's about to get more followers.
She said he was about to get more followers, but what she meant was more harassment. Thursday afternoon, Trump did the same on Twitter because they claim the man's views were a smoking gun of institutional bias by Twitter. The White House, in a panic, then flailed for ways to harm Twitter's business by undercutting a piece of federal law called Section 230 of the Communications Decency Act, a law that holds digital platforms harmless for the mischief of their users. Unlike publishers who can be sued over the content they print, Twitter, Facebook, and so on are deemed common carriers. Without the protection of Section 230, they'd have to take on the expense of lawyers and moderation costs and delete much of the free content they sell ads against. This is Republican Congressman Matt Gaetz, one of Trump's fiercest allies.
I say no special carve-out in our law for big tech. I am currently working with House Judiciary members to revise Section 230 so that we do not have this type of election interference from companies like Twitter going forward.
For years, Trump has used Twitter and other venues to charge Democrats with electoral fraud. He claims, with zero evidence, that the fraud cost him the popular vote majority in 2016 and is being ramped up to rig the vote again in November.
They have to be very careful because you know the things with bundling and all of the things that are happening with votes by mail, where thousands of votes are gathered. And I'm not going to say which party does it, but thousands of votes are gathered and they come in and they're dumped in a location. And then all of a sudden you lose elections that you think you're going to win. I won't stand for it.
Nope. Voter fraud in general has been found by authorities of red states and blue to be negligible. And there is bipartisan support for mail-in ballots as a secure way to vote. But Trump continues to foment doubt about a fair election. And now he claims the fact-check flag is illegal censorship. On Thursday, he signed an executive order seeking to limit Twitter's access to Section 230 protection. Swisher says Trump is just lashing out, and he knows it.
Trump's claims about mail-in ballots are incorrect. So take them to court about those flags. Knock yourself out. But guess what? You're going to lose. The judge would throw it immediately out. And the issue is that tech needs to be regulated. It needs to be regulated smartly. And this is not that. This will only solidify the power of tech because they're going to take a stupid shot at them and lose.
Perhaps Twitter, amid the White House's impotent thrashing, was then emboldened to hide the president's looting and shooting tweet. Dorsey finally permitted what Trump critics have been demanding for years. But is this as far as they dare go? I asked Swisher. In your recent op-ed, you mused over the notion of Twitter giving Trump the Alex Jones treatment and just deplatforming him altogether.
The reason you get taken off a platform is you violate their rules and then you're warned about it several times. That's what happened to Alex Jones. He has not been warned yet. Now, he could be warned, and he keeps doing it, and they take him off. But they're very loath to remove him because he's newsworthy. One of the things I think will happen if you do that, it becomes his liberty cry for his base. And it doesn't really accomplish what you need to do, which is to make sure that the things that he is tweeting do not break the rules of Twitter or Facebook or whatever platform he's on. We all have to think as a society, our legislators, our media, our tech companies have to get together and figure out what's the best way to do this. These can be tools, all these digital devices. They don't have to be weapons, and they can bring people together. And you've seen it during this coronavirus, some wonderful stuff on Twitter, some of the comedy, things like that. It doesn't have to degenerate into this, and it doesn't have to be always focused on Donald Trump. He just happens to be the most perfect example of when everything goes wrong with these inventions.
Maybe you've wondered why Joe Scarborough doesn't just sue the pants off of his accuser for libel. As a public figure, Scarborough would have to demonstrate actual malice, a defamatory statement made, quote, with knowledge that it was false or with reckless disregard of whether it was false or not. But come on, murder of a woman who wasn't murdered and Scarborough 900 miles away? Open and shut case, right? Well, probably, if such a suit could be litigated, but it's an almost impossible legal hill to climb. Bradley Moss is a partner at the law firm of Mark S. Zaid. In 2008, he represented Marines who tried unsuccessfully to sue the late Pennsylvania Congressman John Murtha, only to be stymied by a federal law called the Westfall Act. Back in 2017, the last time Trump trotted out the Scarborough nonsense, Moss revisited Westfall, passed by Congress several decades ago, which gives federal employees immunity from claims of loss or harm that come from the course of their official duties.
And the way the courts have construed this in litigation that's been brought over the years is that when it comes to something like defamation or libel, it doesn't matter what the actual substantive content, the verbiage was that was used. All that matters is the context in which it was made. And so in this regard, with respect to the president's tweets and Joe Scarborough, the way the courts would view it is it's within his scope of his responsibilities to speak to the public and to speak to the press about matters of what he would view as public interest. It doesn't matter what he says, what the particular content is. All that matters is that his action was within the scope of his official responsibilities, and therefore he personally cannot be sued no matter what he says.
But you can prevail upon the attorney general, can you not, to, in some cases, theoretically, to stipulate that a given tweet is personal and does not have anything to do with his responsibilities as an elected official. Is that a path that someone could take?
They could take it. In this context, though, it would be almost certain to fail. If so, Joe Scarborough, for example, were to sue the president for his tweets, what would happen is that the attorney general would issue what's called a Westfall certification, in which he would state that I have concluded that the president's actions were within the scope of his official responsibilities. And he's going to do that based off past practice, past case law, that the president speaking to the press, speaking to the public is part of his official responsibility, no matter what the content. And that therefore, as a result, the U.S. government would move to intervene and substitute itself for the president, and then replace Donald Trump as the defendant with the U.S. government as the defendant.
Uh-huh. And what happens when you sue the U.S. government?
The problem you run into is the U.S. government itself has never made itself subject to libel lawsuits in this context for anything its people do within the scope of their responsibilities. The lawsuit would then be dismissed under the existing statutory laws like the Westfall Act, and the lawsuit dies.
There is an argument that says, well, this is Trump's personal Twitter account, so he's personally liable.
Sure. So that was addressed very early on in his presidency, because we had never had a president who had used a personal Twitter account like this while being president. And so the government had to figure out how to deal with Trump and his personal tweeting. Some of the responses from the government came out in some of my litigation under the Freedom of Information Act when we were trying to address how to respond, how to consider the context of disclosures Donald Trump was making from his personal account as opposed to the White House account. And it was the government's statements in documents to the court and in hearings that they treat any statement, anything uttered by Donald Trump on his personal account as an official statement from the office of the president.
Now, many others have used Twitter to pass along this Scarborough smear. Could Scarborough, if he wished, get anywhere trying to make an example of them to establish guardrails on social media fulminations?
You know, let's say, for example, that one of the president's kids who were not in government service, you know, say Eric Trump or Donald Trump Jr. or Tiffany Trump, let's say they were to craft their own tweets and repeat, you know, basically verbatim some of what the president has said. That would put them at risk, but it would have to be an independent, separate action. It couldn't just be them, for example, retweeting what the president had stated. It would have to be that Eric Trump would separately say something. Then Joe Scarborough would have some manner of legal recourse against Eric Trump.
And what about Joe Schmo with six followers?
He certainly could if he were to so choose. But it's not like if he were to file that lawsuit and win that lawsuit against, you know, random troll A, that he could then file quickie lawsuits against everybody else. He would have to run each individual lawsuit on its own. There'd be issues of discovery. There'd be issues of lengthy, you know, pleadings, and it takes years each time, and it just wouldn't be worth it for him. That's why, by and large, most public figures don't regularly file defamation or libel lawsuits, because it's usually not worth their while. They only do it in very select circumstances or where it's so egregious they decide they can't let it slide.
We've gone through various unavailing legal strategies for dealing with toxic presidential tweeting. If you're a citizen looking elsewhere in the law for protection, are you pretty much out of luck?
The reason for this was because, given how powerful the presidency is supposed to be, given that he is the commander in chief, the ultimate authority on going to war, on launching a nuclear missile, on doing so many things, the Constitution didn't want that person to be burdened with unceasing lawsuits over every little thing. They wanted the public, through the election process or the separate independent political branch, Congress, through its impeachment mechanism, to be the only ones who could remove him or eventually her from office or otherwise restrict what they do. Beyond that, this person who sits in that office, who was elected, who was, you know, got the necessary votes from the Electoral College under the Constitution, is the person who decides how they're going to behave in that context, no matter how unethical or immoral we may view it.
So, out of luck.
Mm-hmm.
Brad, thank you so much.
Not a problem. Anytime.
Bradley Moss is a partner at the law firm Mark S. Zade. He wrote, "Could Joe Scarborough sue President Trump for libel?" in Politico in 2017. Trump's Friday tweet that, in Twitter's words, glorified violence, was prompted by rioting in Minneapolis that culminated in the burning of a police station. So, let's talk about arson. Let's for a moment suppose an incendiary politician were to set fire to the truth.
The second question was about your tweets about the woman who died, who you're suggesting that Joe Scarborough was responsible.
Yeah, a lot of people suggest that, and hopefully someday people are going to find out. Certainly a very suspicious situation, very sad and very suspicious.
Of course, the ladder trucks and pumpers of journalism would come racing to extinguish the blaze.
The woman's death was ruled an accident, and police never suspected foul play.
What has just taken place is a basic exercise in public safety. The first responders had no bias against combustion. What Trump and his enablers in Congress and the media have done for years is set fires. And when the inspectors general and the House of Representatives and the intelligence community and the special counsel and especially the press seek accountability from the firebugs, the arsonists claim to be not perps, but victims of a vast conspiracy built on partisan bias.
Clearly, the mainstream media has an agenda here, and their agenda is to hurt the president of the United States.
More people are going to start to just disappear from the internet because they express opinions that Silicon Valley might not like.
They say, oh, there's no censorship in social media. That's all made up. That's all fake. You and I know the truth is that the social media giants would love to shut us down.
They also exploit the bonus element of distraction. Each new fire takes the public's mind off of the last one, such as the denialism that has contributed to 100,000 COVID dead. Life and death crises become hapless casualties of the news cycle. And beyond that, from the ashes rise still more dangerous lies, such as the first one Twitter flagged to make the week's conflict with the president a five-alarm affair.
Where thousands of votes are gathered, and I'm not going to say which party does it, but thousands of votes are gathered and they come in and they're dumped in a location, and then all of a sudden you lose elections if you think you're going to win.
This narrative is designed to cast doubt on the 2020 election, and with that doubt, a horror show of authoritarian possibilities. This is not a free speech issue. It is a life or death democracy issue. Our society is ablaze in lies. So please, focus on the arsonists, not the firefighters, because all that we cherish risks burning to the ground. That's it for this week's show. On the Media is produced by Alana Casanova-Burgess, Michael Loewinger, Leah Fetter, John Hanrahan, Zandra Ellen, and Eloise Blondio. And our show was edited by Brooke. Our technical director is Jennifer Munson. Our engineers this week were Sam Baer and Josh Hahn.
Katya Rogers is our executive producer. On the Media is a production of WNYC Studios. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield.